Good evening. This is Steve Coughlin from Unconstrained Analytics, Inc. This briefing is the Dialogue Praxis Process, otherwise known as the process of Marxism in its purest form, as aligned with the political warfare model, the Maoist insurgency model. This is the second recording in a series. The first one was done earlier today, the introduction, and parts six, the insurgency pyramid overlay, and part seven, the demonstrative example, intersectionality, with the idea that we would give a demonstration of how this understanding of Marxism generates the picture we did, and then we would back up and then show how do we get there. So tonight, this section will concern itself with part one and part two. Part one, the Wizard's Grimoire, and then what you need to know about Aufheben. So the Wizard's Grimoire really has to do with the fact that Marxism is built on Hegel's metaphysic. And this is something that is such a tight fit that it's almost, and I will argue, is impossible to understand Marxism without understanding that is completely driven by Hegel. It is the archetype form on which Marxism operates. And I'll argue that to understand that archetype form is more powerful than trying to understand it from within the Marxist paradigm, because it shows the dynamic of the element and how things get pulled into it. And of course, like everything in Hegel's worldview, there's always a triadic nature to it, meaning there's always threes, triangles, and stuff like that. Now, we're calling this the archetype form in terms of how it relates to Marxism, but in truth, there is actually a higher archetype form, but that's the discussion for a different presentation. So we're going to start with the idea, looking at a man named Erich Vogelin, who was a famous German, then American political scientist, philosopher, who ended his career at Stanford University. In 1972, he wrote an article on Hegel, A Study in Sorcery. And he called Hegel a sorcerer and his philosophy a grimoire, which is a book of incantations and spells. And the thing I think is very important to understand here is that Vogelin was serious when he referred to Hegel as a sorcerer. Now, by that, he didn't mean that Hegel got, put on a wizard's hat and, had his magic wand and did these incantations and spells. What he was saying is Hegel had a worldview that put him in line with those kind of ideas, and that the way he expressed his ideas was in many respects a covert expression of esoteric beliefs. And of course, this was something that was recognized by everybody in the time, and especially recognized by Marx, Lenin, and Mao. So let's take a couple quotes from Vogelin, because he's coming in from the mystical side. Once you have entered the magic circle the sorcerer has drawn around himself, you are lost. Once you go into the red, if you are in the matrix and you have taken the blue pill, you're lost. This briefing is going to make numerous analogies to the matrix, just to link up these philosophical views with something people say, aha. Because I could also say, once you are drawn into the pseudo reality created by Hegel, you're lost. Next one, the substance becomes the subject, and the subject the substance. In the process of a consciousness that is immanent to itself, of course, Hegel does not state this principle of construction as badly as I have done it now, or the enterprise of his grimoire would be self-defeating. The reader would justly ask what a consciousness is that is nobody's consciousness could possibly be. I want you to focus on this, what's highlighted in red, because this is where to keep coming back to this. If you really broke through and broke down on what Hegel said in simple sentences, you'd find out that there's an awful lot of nothing there. The difficulties just exemplified make it impossible to understand the purpose of the grimoire without a code, Vogelin said, with a code at hand that will permit decipherment page after page. Now, this is very important when you want to understand insurgency, political warfare, covert activities, that people oftentimes talk in code, and you have to figure out what the code, that there is a code, and you have to figure out what the key. And of course, Vogelin is making that point right here. But where there are codes, there are also keys. And this briefing will spend some time trying to go into that. A little bit of history on this grimoire, and kind of a little fun to show that he's really this is not something that's the child of modern science. This is as old as dirt. From the Acts of the Apostles, I don't know, somewhere around maybe 50 AD, many also of those who are now believers came confessing and divulging their practices. And a number of those who practiced magic arts brought their books together and burned them in the sight of all, and they counted the value of them and found it to be 50,000 pieces of silver. I think Vogelin would call those books a grimoire, do you think? And most certainly, when Diocletian found that these magicians in Alexandria were trying to make base metals into gold and thought they might use that to overthrow the Roman Empire, he went as far as to round up those grimoires in 292 AD, and he had them all burned. Now, this briefing today in this section is going to be intensive on having to read things, because we're in the part of it that we just have to make sure we get this down right. So what I'm going to do, where I have to, is read the entire notation, because this is going to be also on just audio. But where we get to one where the writing really only amplifies what we're saying as the main point, I'll just hold for 5 seconds and then move on to the next point. People can stop the clip and read it. So here we have Schopenhauer, and Schopenhauer, who in 1840 spoke horrifically. He was horrified at Hegel, and more importantly, he was horrified at the impact he was having it on the young German minds, and then later on all over Europe. He referred to Hegel's writings as a claptrap of mystification. He was an imposture. It was deception throwing dust in the eyes of the readers, the period of dishonesty. He referred to Hegel as stupid and a clumsy charlatan. And he said many other things. If you want to read this, I'll hold for a couple seconds. But this idea that there's a mystical component to Hegel's worldview is very well established. And if you're reading about Hegel, or you're reading about Marx instantiating Hegel without getting to this mystical aspect, you've actually missed it. And it's important, because in Hegel's writing, The Critique of Hegel's Philosophy of Right, that he wrote in 1843, he made a point of it. He talked about Hegel's obvious mysticism, his pantheistic mysticism, the product of mysticism. He said the mystical substance becomes the real subject, and the real subject appears to be something else, namely a moment of the mystical substance. That kind of sounds like what Vogelin was just saying, if you get down to it, and the mystical idea. So, you know, really, here's Marx, who completely incorporates Hegel, and yet he's really deriding him for his mystical worldviews. And this carries over with Lenin. Lenin referred to Hegel's works as the ultra-nonsensical mysticism. Such mystical nonsense. The mystic idealist spiritualist Hegel, the mysticism, this on Plato, a huge mass of mystical slush. And of course, right in there, he says, triangles from the essence of the sensuous things. He understands the triadic nature, the fact that Hegelian worldviews are kind of like a triangle, or like a three-legged stool if it's turned into a attack narrative, for example. So we should understand that right from the beginning, Marxists, including Hegel, including Marx and Lenin, recognize this. And here we're going to come to a key. This is Bertrand Russell. In 1921, writing on Hegel, he made this comment. Hegel's philosophy is so odd that one would not have expected him to be able to get sane men to accept it, but he did. He set out with so much obscurity that people thought it must be profound. It can easily be expounded lucidly in the words of one syllable, but then the absurdity would become obvious. This is very important, because we'll go through books that are very large later in this brief. Books on critical theory, which are very big. But if you broke them down, just like Hegel, you'd see how absurd they were, and you could break them down, including critical racial theory, or as it exists in the here and now. It'll come to me. So here we come to it. This sentence here, and there's going to be a key I want to lay down. Remember, there's code and there's keys. You'll find in these writings an initiate-laden scientized terms that make it imponderable for non-initiates to understand. What I'm getting at is here, in this ponderous writing, there's code words in there. And the initiates who read it understand it really means one thing, where the uninitiate just keeps on reading. And the key is this. Over-engineered initiate language is an indicator that its complexity may be a smokescreen for the absurd. Why am I giving you this in Hegel when we're really talking about Marx? Because if we can show that Marx basically imports Hegel, this analysis should carry forward into it as well. Any over-engineered book that when you think about it can be broken down to one-third its size if you just cut out so much of the flowery spinning language means that flowery spinning language really exists to make you think there's something there when there's not. And here we are at that three-tiered attack of the Hegelian metaphysic that often just gets broken down to the Hegelian dialectic. So the dialectic here stood as a grimoire. Then that's one line of attack. The other is science of reason that executes by building towards the end state of an idealized future perfect world. And then the idea that the state is God. Okay. Science of reason is what it's called. What I want to basically do for these next series of slides is show you that there's no slush here. There's nothing ethereal about what we're about to say. So from the perspective of the dialectic, you see that it helps reinforce the future perfect world, the science of reason concept, and it also supports the idea that the state is God bestriding the land. And for this presentation, when we use the word dialectic, we mean by the dialectic that it is the manufacturing of binaries to position real cultural or personal values, beliefs, traits, norms, etc., against constructed opposites tailored to characterize those values, beliefs, traits, norms in odious negative terms, leading to their abandonment and destruction through negation. Because it is a constructed opposite, the binary that's created is pseudo-real, not real. It then becomes a part of the backdrop narrative. In the language of the Matrix, it is a blue pill construct. Binaries also seek the subordination of real science to pseudoscience, and we're living that right now. So now we're going to go to the second part of the triadic formula, the state, or the state as God bestriding the land. This becomes important when you think about the fact that if you're a country that is or thinks it is governed under a theory that there are rights endowed by the Creator, what happens when they transition to privileges granted by the state by operation of just adopting the dialectical process? That was a long statement there. So let's take a little segue here and let's see how do we base this idea that Hegel said the state is God bestriding the land? Let's take a look at it. From Hegel's Philosophy of Right from 1820, paragraphs 257 and 258, or sections, I should say, what does he say? The state is the actuality of the ethical idea. It is ethical mind qua substantial will manifest and revealed to itself, knowing and thinking itself. Wow. The state is absolutely rational inasmuch as it is the actuality of the substantial will which it possesses in the particular self-consciousness once that consciousness has been raised to the consciousness of its universality. This substantial unity is an absolute unmoved end in itself. So I would like to point out before finishing this paragraph that both 257 and so far I read in 258, this is in the philosophical world, the language from Aristotle or from Thomas Aquinas. This language here, unmoved mover, you see that? This is the philosophical language defining God. So this is Hegel actually assigning to the state the power of God. So if you really believe that, this final part of 258 would make sense. On the other hand, this final end that the state is God has, because it's true, has supreme right against the individual whose supreme duty is to be a member of the state. Well, that just makes sense. If the state is God bestriding the land, man owes absolute obedience to the state. You know, the Prussians, not Russians, the Prussians really loved Hegel. And that's why they brought him to Berlin. And that's why they unified Germany around this concept of the state. Obedient Germans. Finally, from the philosophy of history, for truth is the unity of the universal and the subjective will, and the universal is to be found in the state. The state is the divine idea as it exists on earth. So really, the people who want to push back against this concept that Hegel believed that the state is not God bestriding the land really need to look at it. And there are absolutely consequences. So, for example, Woodrow Wilson, he considered himself a Hegelian. In fact, Ronald Pestrito wrote a book on Woodrow Wilson, and so did quite a few. I'm just using his as an example. And what did he point out? He pointed out that Wilson was a Hegelian, and he developed Hegelianism. And this creates a problem, because remember, he was the president who had all these constitutional reforms that were enacted, and we need to think about what he thought. What's the problem? What are the consequences when a nation that claims rights endowed by the creator comes under the governing principles that hold that the state is God bestriding the land? So let's take a look at what Hegel was saying when he talked about science of reason. As a pseudoscience, science of reason dislikes and subordinates real science, what Hegel called the lesser science, the science of understanding. Hegel reviled Newton for his scientific breakthroughs in what he considered the inferior realm of the science of understanding, which we would call real science, and that it was always to be subordinated to what? Science of reason, which was what? His philosophical worldview, his metaphysical worldview, posited an idea that he could envision the perfect future end state that was, in his terms, scientifically derived at, from which he could impose his will on people today, including his will on the science of understanding. It's really important to know, understand that Woodrow Wilson knew this. It's also important to know that Hegel disliked Newton because he was a scientist. And it's in this set, it's in this context that we have to understand this excerpt from Hegel in his Philosophy of Nature. He says, according to the familiar Newtonian theory, white or colorless light consists of 5 or 7 colors. The theory itself cannot say exactly how many. One cannot express oneself strongly enough about the barbarism in the first place of a conception that with light too, the worst form of reflection, the compound was seized upon. Further, the ineptitude, the tastelessness, even dishonesty of Newton's observations and experimentation, they must be addressed, as well as the equally bad tendency to draw inferences, conclusions, and proofs from impure empirical data. This is the loathing. His science, Hegel's science of reason, loathed this empirical data. And he also, the blindness of the admiration he got. You can read the rest of this. Finally, there is the blindness of the prejudice that the theory rests on something mathematical. My God, how can the lower science of understanding, which is based on empiricism and math, ever seek to overcome the metaphysical worldview of Hegel's philosophy of nature, which was the science of the philosophy of nature? I wanted to spend a lot of time on that because we can clearly see this language of Hegel attacking Newton and deriding him, because it's how we come to understand Woodrow Wilson's comments. Let me read this, an outtake from Woodrow Wilson. The Constitution was founded on the law of gravitation. The government was to exist and move by virtue of the efficacy of checks and balances. The trouble with this theory, of course, is that government is not a machine, but a living thing. It falls not under the theory of the universe, but under the theory of organic life. It is accountable to Darwin, not to Newton. It is modified by its environment, necessitated by its task, shaped by the sheer pressure of life. So you can see here something about Wilson's New Freedom. Of course, the name of his book that we're quoting from here is The New Freedom. It would seem to me that if we read Woodrow Wilson, at face value, understanding he's making references to Hegel here, that his new freedom broke from the old freedoms ensconced in, well, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. So when the state becomes God, rights endowed by the Creator transition to privileges granted by the state by operation of that process. Under the rubric group rights are positioned to dialectically oppose constitutionally protected individual rights so as to negate them. Group rights are actually state privileges. So how is this formula not an incantation? I just kind of want people to think that Voegelin was expressing something he wanted people to understand. And do you see the code in this language here? It's just this simple. You cannot understand what Wilson was saying without recognizing its nexus to Hegel. You can't. This whole concept of progressivism is built explicitly on it. Privileges granted by the state become institutionalized preferences. So let's take a look at this. Let's blow up a part of this and we'll take a look at it. And you see from this paragraph I blew up and I highlighted some stuff, you can see some keys. He's saying his worldview isn't a theory, it's a fact. And it's the living political constitution. And because it's living, it must be Darwinian in structure and in practice. So living constitutions, you're on notice that this concept of living constitution, which goes back to Woodrow Wilson, is explicitly Hegelian in its understanding, which means living constitutions are explicitly dialectical. By operation of the dialectic, living constitution interpretations are designed to negate the object of what is being interpreted, the Constitution. And it's been that way since 1914. Think about that. So his progressives, all that progressives ask or desire is permission in the era when development, evolution is the scientific word to interpret the Constitution according to the Darwinian principle. All they ask is recognition of the fact that a nation is a living thing and not a machine. So think about this. Put your mind outside of the biological science and what you think about the theory of evolution in the realm of biological science. And we're gonna take a knife and cut it clean because we're talking about Darwin in the context of culture and law. Outside the domain of the biological sciences and from the very beginning, terms like evolution, development, and Darwinian have always served to mask the dialectical processes they instantiate in culture in the name of science. Isn't this what theologians call idolatry? Well, I mean, if you think about it, if the state is God bestriding the land. So the dialectical destruction of America did not begin with Marx. It was already well underway before Marx started taking a bite. It came in with Hegel through people like Woodrow Wilson. Do we see the dialectical, the dialectic? Check. Do we see science of reason, Darwinian? Check. Do we see it depends on the state as God to implement that? Check. It's all there. So returning to the three-pronged attack, science of reason is not science. It is not science. It is a metaphysical claim that exists to instantiate arbitrary state authority. The science that says, I'll give you an example, global warming. But we can't wait for science to validate global warming because if we wait, the world might blow up and we'll be extinct. Global warming is potentially an extinction level event. Therefore, we must give all authority to the state to take action now, to act in the absence of science, to take action. So the science of reason exists to instantiate arbitrary state authority. Think of everything you're being told to do in the name of COVID that, you know, when you think about it, and we should have come past this point by the first week of April, have nothing to do with an epidemic. But think about this as well. Once you declare your political view scientific, the opposition becomes unscientific and therefore defective in their thinking. This is the basis of ridicule. It is what is grounded. It's what Alinsky ultimately grounds his worldview in. So let's do a little rundown on science of reason based on visualizing the perfect future world, declaring that vision of a scientifically real and imposing it on people today. Hegel's science of reason opposes replacement metaphysical claims by designating them science while demanding the Hegelian God, of course the state, to enforce them. This is done through the creation, control, and enforcement of contrived perfect future worlds that obligate current generations to impose and enforce personal and cultural transformation, change, to ensure that that future perfect world is attained. Along with the ideation of the future perfect world, the metaphysical claims that support actions taken to realize that end state are designated to science. Because it is a scientific worldview, resistance is irrational, and right-thinking leaders are under some responsibility to obligate the state to enforce actions leading to their realization to that end state. Hegel believed what is commonly called science, concepts arising from scientific method and falsifiability, to be absolutely inferior and somewhat odious form of science that he labeled the science of understanding. Hegel disliked Newton for his discoveries because it was science. Wilson claimed Darwinian science over Newtonian. When he did this, he was signaling his fidelity to Hegel's science of reason. A science that seeks de jure enforcement is not science. A science that says, as we just did a minute ago, that seeks the state to take action before it's proven, is probably not science. Not as we would like to call it. It is a pseudoscience that seeks to establish a pseudo-reality, sometimes called scientism. And lest we forget, pseudo is just a Greek word for false. So now we're going to go and return to the science of reason and apply it and tell you exactly what's going on here. We're going to give you two examples, one from Vogel and from On Hegel, A Study in Sorcery, that gives you kind of the mystical flavor for what Hegel is doing. And then we'll take a cleaner philosophical view of it from Bertrand Russell. Excuse me here. So how did, and this is the key. This is a key thing to understand. If you can wrap your mind around this, a whole lot of what Marxism is doing becomes instantly perceivable at a very simple level and instantly attackable. What did he say? The third stratum is the imaginative construction of ages that will permit the imaginator to anticipate the future course of history. So what did he say here? The imaginative construction of a perfect world for all the ages that the person who thinks about it sees as being the course of history. By means of this construction, the imaginator, here Hegel, can shift the meaning of existence in order to fulfill this purpose. Hegel's project must first of all eclipse all unknown futures by the image of a known future. It must further endow the construction of the ages with the certainty of science. My vision of the future is scientifically derived. A system of science, and it must conceive the future age in such a manner that the present imaginator becomes its inaugurator and master. This is megalomania on a grand scale. Well, don't you think Marx? Don't you think Stalin? Don't you think Hitler? Don't you think Pol Pot all thought that because they had that perfect vision, they had the right, nay, they had the responsibility to take the actions that had to be taken to see that end. So downstream, how do you understand the science in Marx's scientific socialism? Here's a more mainstream explanation of the same thing from Bertrand Russell, and it also gives you a key. And from 1921. Philosophers have professed to discover a formula of progress, showing that the world was becoming gradually more and more to their liking. The recipe for a philosophy of this type is simple. The philosopher first decides which are the features of the existing world that give him pleasure and which are the features that give him pain. He then, by a careful selection among the facts, persuades himself that the universe is subject to a general law, leading to an increase of what he finds pleasant and a decrease in what he finds unpleasant. Next, having formulated his law of progress, he turns on the public and says, "It is fated that the world must develop as I say. Therefore, those who wish to be on the winning side of history and do not care to wage fruitless war against the inevitable will join my party. Those who oppose him are condemned as unphilosophic, unscientific, and out of date, while those who agree with him feel assured of victory, since, of course, the universe is on our side. History is on our side." If you actually speak in terms of history being on your side, remember, you're in the dialectic. You know, I like to point out that whereas people will point out that Voegelin was a conservative, actually, Bertrand Russell was a progressive. So this is pretty, this is not as controversial in certain circles as many would think. So let's just break this down a little. By establishing the illusion of scientific certainty, the illusion of inevitability is sustained. Ridicule campaigns can be sustained against the opposition for the refusal to recognize the inevitability of claims based on the certainty of their science. So one of the things to think about, never ever fight pseudo-realities. Fight pseudo-realities in the other side's constructed pseudo-reality. If you do, you're already being defeated. It's like fighting against the matrix after choosing to take the blue pill. The fight against pseudo-realities only begins after the red pill is taken. Just think about that. What does that mean? No jujitsu. When you say we will jujitsu and beat them at their own game, you can only do that if you're in the pseudo-reality. And because the pseudo-reality only exists to destroy you, your jujitsu is like fighting against the tide. Jujitsu is a blue pill defense of a red pill attack. So do we have any examples of science of reason in our modern time? Well, the backbone of Marxism is dialectical materialism based on scientific socialism, scientism, science fiction, mythology pointed forward. In biblical analysis, Wellhausen and other biblical analysis, anything that has historical critical in it, JEPD, the Quella Gospels, theory, not science of evolution, cultural Darwinism, complexity theory, the world is so complex, all we can do is manage chaos. Global warming and COVID-19 enforcement narratives, which severable from COVID-19 itself. So here we have it. We have the dialectic. We have the goddess, the status god bestriding the land. And we have the perfect future world. And each one of them is generating traffic. Each one of them is generating narratives. And each one of these reinforces each other. This is important because they exist only to go after the average citizen that's in the middle. That's the only reason this exists, to isolate you. Because the average citizens do not know they are being targeted for attack. They don't see those arrows coming at them. Because they don't, they cannot know that these attacks reinforce each other constantly. It's kind of a trinity. And that's not an accident, by the way. So, and each one of them brings their metaphysical claims from up in their center of power right here down into going after the person, going after the average person, society, culture, beliefs. Perceiving you're under assault by various forces of the universe, you fail to recognize they are targeted attacks that are also coordinated and interlocking. In fact, you're targeted. So here we see the wizard's grimoire, Hegel. So at the top is a wizard in the dialectic. To the right is the status god bestriding the land. And to the left is science of reason, the visualization of the future perfect world. But all we have to do is take one click and boom, it's Marxism. Scientific science of reason becomes scientific socialism working for the workers' paradise. The omniscient state is the all-powerful state. This is a one-to-one fit between Marx and Hegel, a one-to-one fit. And you can't get your hands around this Marxist construct unless you understand that it is immediately built upon this Hegelian model. It's simply a matter of cutting and pasting. Scientific socialism, cultural Darwinism, global warming, complexity, COVID narratives. We could go on, and you may well recognize this now. But this attack right here, as you see it, this is not how the target perceives the attack. Who's the target? You. This is not how you perceive this attack. In fact, the problem is you may not perceive it at all because it's all clouded. The target is in a political warfare fog. I use the word fog intentionally because we're talking about political warfare. As our quote from the Chinese colonels in Unrestricted Warfare said and made clear, one, political warfare is a form of war. And two, it's the form of war that Americans, including our national security establishment, doesn't even perceive and will not ever perceive. So when we talk about the fog of war, yeah, we're talking about that. So the target, America, Americans, the average citizen, he's in a political warfare fog. He's strategically disoriented. He may not recognize the threat. He may not even recognize there is a threat, and he cannot articulate a targetable response. You are the target. When executed as part of a mass line effort, obvious targets do not present themselves. This is what a Hegelian attack looks like to you. So how does this work? Well, let's develop another picture here. Hegelian metaphysic, because it's not just the dialectic as you're maybe starting to see, is Hegelian metaphysic is teleologically informed, executes along an arc, we'll call it a narrative arc, through time on a trajectory. What am I saying? It is always moving along an arc through time to a target. That's what we mean by teleology. There's an end state. There's something that it's moving toward. For the target, dialectical attacks are disorienting. Remember, you are the target. See the target in the crosshairs there? So it's kind of, you know, we'll use a metaphor looking at these two guys playing checkers here to explain how the dialectical attacks really work. I want you to take it seriously. I'm trying to make it a little light, and you'll get the point. We like to think of our foes as an equal opposite, following the same strategies to win as we do, but just on the other side of a table, as if a flat two-dimensional surface, like playing checkers. It's just the same way we visualize the solar system. And yet, this is how the solar system really moves. It's on a helical trajectory moving through time and space. It's really not left versus right, it's opposing poles. Thinking we are contending against a mirror image foe fighting along a flat horizontal plane, the foe actually attacks elliptically along a vertical axis on a trajectory through time. And I do apologize for these graphics, but this is the outer limit of my skills. While we like to think the other side is moving horizontally along a flat plane, his movements actually reflect a vertical helix, which comes right through the table. You see that old guy there with the pipe? His job isn't really to play checkers with you. His job is to keep you at the table, playing at checkers as the attack comes through the table. This leads us to conclude that the other side's moves make no sense when in fact it is we who are confused. Actually strategically disoriented. In my homage to Monty Python, wait, get back here, fight. It's only a flesh wound. While the man playing checkers, your opponent on the left, he never moves and he never is moved. His job is to fix you, to hold you at that table while you jujitsu him at his own game for as long as he requires. This is complete reality dislocation.